Welcome, everyone, to this special Monday night edition of Narsil in Action. Sorry for the technical delays and the issues with the launch, but we are now launched. We may go over a little bit depending on how the interview goes. So we would like to welcome everybody, and this is an overwhelming response. So we're so flattered that people signed up for these calls and the support that you express for us. We would certainly welcome assistance in planning and promoting future programs of this nature. All you have to do is contact Narsil. If you have an idea and you'd like to host or assist in putting one of these together, we'd be happy to hear from you. Andy, who you're hearing in the background, he's the co-host of Registry Matters podcast, and he's making everything work smoothly tonight. So during the first hour, we're going to provide a very brief update on the upcoming Halloween challenge that Narsil plans to initiate in the state of Georgia. And this challenge has to do with two sheriffs who've decided to impose their own signage requirements on those registered within their jurisdiction without a corresponding state or city ordinance to support them. Even though we will have that brief update, the primary focus of the first hour will be removal from registration and how that process works in Georgia. Our special guest will be attorney Mark Juracek, who's leading the team on the Halloween challenge, and you should know that he has handled many successful removal petitions in Georgia. The second hour will be open forum and a segment of Can They Do That? And our special guest will be Ashley Cloud, who's the staff attorney for New Mexico's Liberty and Justice Coalition, which is Narsil's affiliate, and Ms. Cloud will provide generalized responses to questions regarding whether or not a particular requirement can be imposed and whether or not there might be a viable cause of action. Also, Ms. Cloud will provide a very brief update on New Mexico's litigation plans. We plan to award a free registration to the 2020 conference at some point tonight. So those of you who have not texted yet, we sent out a phone number for you to text to enter the contest. Everybody doesn't register for these calls. So if you would like to enter, text that number now, 747-227-4477, and put the word contest in there. And Andy will confirm that, and he will give you a contestant number. And then at some point tonight, and I can pretty well guarantee it'll be the second hour because we've already lost some minutes in the first hour, we'll draw a contestant number. And if you're on the call, we will award you a registration certificate to come to our 2020 conference in Raleigh. So now it's time to introduce Mark Juracek, who's been with us before. He'll be with us for the first hour. Mr. Juracek is an Atlanta-based attorney who has been admitted to practice since the year 2000. I think he's also admitted in Virginia. Mr. Juracek recently won a significant decision in the case of State versus Park. And State versus Park dealt with Georgia's lifetime GPS requirements imposed on offenders after they completed their court-ordered sentences. Welcome again, Mark, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
We're going to have to get those 6 minutes back. We're going to spend just a brief amount of time on the Halloween challenge. The issue is that in two of your 159 counties, we became aware last Halloween Eve that those counties intended to require signage of various. One was going to put I think signs and yards, and the other one is going to require people to post signage. And we advised them that they didn't have any authority to do that. And as far as we know, they proceeded anyway. So we've elected to attempt to challenge that so it doesn't happen again this year. So can you tell us how that's progressing in some generalized terms? We don't want to get into specifics of strategy or who the plaintiffs are, but are we moving along with that? And is there a good chance that we'll have that launched before Halloween?
There will definitely be an action file before Halloween. We are sifting through some names and some information concerning potential plaintiffs, trying to sort that out first. Once we do that, we will proceed to, polish up our complaint and file a 1983 complaint in two different federal courts, I believe, the Middle District of Georgia as well as the Northern District of Georgia, and also seek a preliminary injunction for the action taken, that being making offenders place signage in their homes or on their lawns, be that as it may. So we're moving right along. We're progressing nicely. I don't really care to get too far into details about the exact progress and all of that, but I will note, you know, just as you noted when you were introducing me, that the challenge that we're bringing here is not one saying that the authority by which the police are acting is unconstitutional. Rather, what we're saying is that the police in this case, or the sheriffs in both counties, lack authority to do what they did, and they're essentially ultra vires with these actions. So we think we can make a pretty strong case for this in both jurisdictions, and we're looking forward to moving on with it. Certainly, your listeners may not think so, but Halloween approaches rapidly when you're talking about a litigation schedule, so we really are working hard to get something out as soon as possible on that.
And we had a meeting in Georgia, and your schedule didn't permit you to attend, but we had a meeting, some 30 people, or close to 30 people showed up in Locust Grove. And then after that meeting, we had a cranky email from a person who said, well, all of you people are talking good stuff, but why aren't you trying to get a restraining order for the retaliation that's certain to follow? And I just was amazed. I said, well, it's difficult to have a restraining order for something that they might do. Can you illuminate why that we can't ask for restraint on something that hasn't happened yet?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Asking for a restraining order for something that might happen is not really something that we can really do. A restraining order is a reactive rather than proactive type of action. Now, what I will say is that, of course, you know, that's kind of the purpose of the injunction, is to enjoin them from acting. And certainly if they act in contradiction to an injunction, then they're in contempt of court and they're going to have all kinds of problems after that. It's a nice idea to say, hey, sheriffs, you can't retaliate for this, that, and the other, but it's not realistic to say, you are enjoined from taking this action, and there's, you know, you're restrained from doing anything else. And sheriffs have a job in Georgia. They have obligations. They have duties. They're well within their rights to act within their duties. And again, what we're alleging here is that they're going beyond their state-given powers in acting this way. So that's what we're focused on. And, if there are incidents of retaliation that people feel like are happening, then we'll have to just take those as they come.
So, well, I think that's a sufficient update. We will get more information out to folks as this case begins to unfold. I'm sure we'll announce when the complaint is filed, and we'll have you on to talk about the progress of when there's something that we can go public on. But 150 people didn't sign up to hear about Halloween, I'm quite certain. Probably the more important part of your hour is the removal from registration process, and that's covered in OCGA 42-1-19 for those legal beagles out there who want to follow along. And I would like to take a dive into the removal process in Georgia, and let's begin by, are there any offenses that are just not eligible to file the petition by virtue of the offense itself?
Yeah, no, Georgia does not have a categorical classification rule, or they are categorical in terms of the offenses that will cause registration. But in terms of offenses that would cause removal, they are not. What Georgia will do, or what Georgia does by virtue of its law, is that if you are classified as not a level one low risk offender, you're going to have to serve out your sentence and then wait 10 years before you are eligible for removal from the registry. There's a lot of different ways to skin that cat in terms of removal. Okay. But No, the short answer to your question is that there's not any categorical denial because you got convicted of rape or aggravated child molestation or what have you. There is not.
Well, that's good to clarify, because we've got people out there who say, well, I would never be eligible. And I said, well, I don't know of any a particular offense that's excluded the way I read that section. So I'm glad that we agree. Now, what's going to confuse people is when you said level one, people are going to associate all these registration schemes around the country where they take a categorical approach to putting people at levels. Now, when Georgia's, when you're at level one, is that a categorical level, or is that based on an assessment that's done of the individual?
Well, it's based on an assessment, an individualized assessment. So in that regard, Georgia has conformed itself with what most states have said is necessary in order to classify. And I should point out that classification is the second step in terms of being a sex offender. In Georgia, you would be classified, or you'd be categorized as a sex offender because of a conviction for a number of enumerated offenses plus a catch-all provision, which has been the bane of my existence for a long time, which says that any offense that by its nature is sexual can land you on there too, which I for the life of me still think is a vague an unconstitutionally vague provision, but I've argued and lost that already. So once you're on the registry, then you will be classified in one of three tiers. Tier one being the lowest risk, tier two being a moderate risk, and tier three, as currently defined, says that you're just a risk. That's been argued, and I've argued that in court before, and I do think that somebody's going to come along and successfully argue that that's an unconstitutionally vague classification, but for our purposes, those are the three tiers, and the state of Georgia will argue with you that the third tier is always going to be the worst of the worst and the most likely to reoffend. Something that around the country often gets called a sexually dangerous predator. That's what they're called in Georgia as well.
So the tier one, the level one, the level two, that's actually an individualized. It's not because of the offense. It's through a process.
No, they are assessed individually as and you know, in terms of their risk to reoffend. That's right.
Okay, well, so those of you listening out there, don't become confused, because if you're a level three in Florida, or tier three, or whatever they refer to you as in Florida, that does not mean you're going to be that level in Georgia once they've done the leveling of a person, if they should move from Florida to Georgia. Florida doesn't control what Georgia levels a person. Okay, now, there, under this 421-19A, there's an opportunity for people to file a petition who haven't waited the 10 years. And it looks like to me that it provides the out for people with disabilities, people in hospice or totally incapacity. Can you shed a little bit light on that? Because there's people in the country who can't even get into a nursing home, who can't be admitted because they're on the registry. So I'm very, very interested in this, not having to wait 10 years for filing for that relief.
Well, yes, age or, physical, mental condition, physical condition, mental. There's actually no, there's no provision for mental, but totally and permanently disabled, as that term is defined elsewhere in the code, and if you're seriously physically incapacitated as well, those are the incapacitation provisions. But actually, Larry, there's another way you can come off in less than 10 years after your probation, parole, etc., after your sentence is served out. And if you are a first tier offender, if you've been leveled at level one, and at that point, once you've completed all of your sentence, then you are immediately eligible to come off. And I actually have had more success with people like that than anybody who's dealing with a health issue or had to wait 10 years.
That's very, very good information to know. So the people that are level one do not have to wait 10 years. So, We're zipping through these questions, and we're going to try to get to as many of the callers because I'm sure there will be plenty. So let's go into where the petition is filed. There are people. The way I read it is you're confined to filing the petition where your conviction arises, unless you're from out of state. How close am I on that?
Say that one more time, Larry.
It appears you have to file the petition in the county of your conviction, unless your conviction is from out of state. How close did I get to that? Where does people file their petition?
I think it is the county of conviction. It's the county of conviction. I just looked at it in the statute again. I just had to double check myself. It's in the county of conviction. If you're from out of state, if your conviction arises out of state, it's the county where you live. And where you register.
So a person who happens to have already moved to Georgia, or someone who should move to Georgia, you would probably want to be very careful about where you would plop yourself down if you intend to file one of these petitions, because I'm guessing there's some deviation in terms of the discharge and removal of granting these petitions. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, I don't know if the numbers are actually published, but certainly, you know, there are counties where I feel more confident going in to make the argument someone should be removed versus other counties. But Georgia is also a little strange for a number of reasons. But in this particular context, it's a little strange because you will also meet with some very conservative hanging type judges who will also be quite libertarian and have some strong disagreements with the whole notion of a sex offender registry. Who will possibly be more favorable than, you know, your typical, you know, big city judge who everyone thinks is going to be, you know, light on this stuff. I haven't seen a real consistency about that other than, perhaps running into a couple of former prosecutors of sex crimes, which I really didn't want to have to argue those kind of cases to. It would not be a bad idea to get the lay of the land before you moved here, to get an idea of which counties are stricter in terms of how they obligate sex offenders. Because I would totally agree that the treatment of offenders in different parts of the state is not completely consistent, or even within a standard deviation.
Okay, so these petitions are filed. Who was the responding party? So you have your petition. Who do you serve it on?
The state of Georgia. It'd be served on the attorney general's office. It'd be served on the district attorney, the local district attorney, as well as the sheriff of the county where you are applying.
And so that would be the county of conviction if you have a Georgia conviction, or the county of residence if you have relocated to Georgia.
That brings up a bit of a quirk, because if you're living outside the county of conviction, you still serve it on the local sheriff, I believe. It's the sheriff of the county where he resides. I was going to say that doesn't sound right. It is the sheriff where they reside.
Okay. So and which party bears the burden, and what is that burden, that standard of proof that must be met to get off the registry?
Well, it's a preponderance burden. In other words, it's more likely than not that the person does not pose a substantial risk of perpetrating a future dangerous sexual offense. And as that language implies, the burden is going to be on the offender to prove it. So in other words, you're going to have to go in there with evidence. Obviously the perfect evidence is like psychosexual, evaluations from psychiatrists, lots of anecdotal stuff from friends, neighbors, clergy, coworkers, all these people saying that, you know, what happened in the past is something that happened in the past and not who this present person is, as well as, you know, probably a some kind of willingness on the part of the offender to address the past conviction. Unfortunately, I can tell you anecdotally that I once had a judge who directly stated that because my client didn't get up and apologize for the crime of conviction, that he was not going to let my client off of the registry, even though that client, I think, was one of the better candidates I've ever represented for someone to come off the sex offender registry. And that's something I fought pretty hard in the appellate courts and didn't get anywhere with, because judges have that much discretion. I don't think that whether a person apologizes not really has any bearing on whether they are more likely than not to commit a future dangerous sexual offense, but I will assure you that no client I have is ever going to not apologize for what happened going forward, because if that spells the difference between removal from registry and not, I think everyone would agree that's probably, it's probably best to get up there and do that, as long as it's what's in your heart.
So, I'm going to ask you, and I know this is going to be a difficult one. I strongly urge those who would consider filing a petition to have representation, to have people who've done these petitions, ask them tough questions about, have you filed any of these? What's the success rate of your filing? I strongly encourage people not to file them pro se. I'm going to go ahead and short circuit that question. It's in here because of interest of time. But is there an average price that a good attorney such as yourself would charge? And I know it's going to vary somewhat on the distance from your office to where the petition is going to be heard. But people are out there wondering, you already said a psychosexual evaluation is ideal. So what would they be looking at in terms of representation to proceed with this very important process?
Well, let me start by saying I prefer not to discuss specifics about fees in an open forum. But I will say that if it's done right, one who is charged with a sex offense or convicted of a sex offense and is a registered sex offender trying to come off of, in Georgia's case, the lifetime registration requirements, should be prepared. You're not going to spend just a couple hundred bucks on this. It's going to be in the thousands. And frankly, you would have to be very choosy about the lawyers you choose to handle it, because there will be people who take that kind of money who don't really know what they're doing and think they can probably just finesse an ADA into letting that happen. And it's not often that you get that accomplished. I will say, I know I'm not the only lawyer who's been through this process dozens of times already. And it's a relatively new law. I think, let me double check, but I think it's only been in place for a few years. Yeah, 2015. So it's only been in place for about 4 years. So, I have dealt with this a good number of times, and even the DA's offices don't always know how to deal with them. It depends on how big a county you're dealing with, but some of them haven't really encountered it, so even at this point. So you have to be careful about where you put your money, but I would say that a competent lawyer is going to be asking, I would say, a minimum of $5,000 for this kind of work, and the price will go up as the complexity of the case goes up. So I would just I'd warn the listeners that is the case, but as you said, there's dangers of the flip side of going pro se. Which is always the right of the individual. And I understand that some people, every client I have knows his case better than I do because he's lived it. But at the same time, that can be just as much of a danger as it is a benefit. And what the petitioners need to realize is, if you lose in Georgia and they deny you relief, you are on the bench for 3 more years. In other words, you cannot apply again for 3 years. And if you've had one application that's been denied, my suspicion is that it's going to be looked at with a good deal of suspicion in terms of, when you can be, when the judge looks at it another time. I'd like to correct one thing. I think the law has actually been enacted since 2010. But the rest of what I say goes. I mean, it's important that these petitioners keep in mind that it's not just reward out there. There is a bit of risk too. So it's best to consult an attorney, to have an attorney representing you going in there. I think, I'm clearly biased in that situation, but I also think in this particular circumstance, it's absolutely the right thing to do.
Well, I just don't understand how you would have the conversation with the DA's office, because if I were admitted to practice law, the first thing I would do is get on the horn with the DA or either drop by in person, depending on location. And I'd say, how do you feel about this person? I'm getting ready to file a petition. What's your level of anxiety? Well, you can't go in there as a pro se person and say, how do you feel about me? I mean, they're just not going to have the conversation with you about how they feel about you. That's why you have a spokesperson to have the negotiations for the DA and say, well, what would your consternation be less if I were able to show these things, including the psychosexual evaluation? But I'm going to want to take the pulse of the DA's office before I go forward. But that's just what I think I would want to do. But anyway, we're going to try to move on to calls. I'm going to short circuit a couple of questions I had, and let's people star six will get you in the queue. And if you press star six now, I will call on you in the order that you're in the queue. We have two from apparently already, and everybody, please. He's an expert in a number of things, including GPS monitoring. If you go down that rabbit hole of anything other than this, I'm going to have to mute your microphone, and we're going to stay focused on questions about the removal process. And I apologize for that, but that's where we need to contain the questions for tonight's call. So star six, and I'm going to ask you to keep your questions as brief as you can. No story is needed. We'll ask you a question if we need more information. So we're going to area code 321. You're on Narsil in Action with Mark Yerchak. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead with your question, Hello. Please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, please proceed with your question.
If you're out of state, how long do you have to be in Georgia before you can file a petition?
Well, what would happen if you're out of state? As a matter of fact, I just spoke to somebody about this today. If you are from out of state and you come to Georgia, and let's say you have to register in another state. You know, Larry pointed out that I work in Virginia as well, so let's say you come from Virginia. If you come from Virginia and are registered in Georgia or Virginia, you will have to register in Georgia as well. Okay. I see some issues with that, because there are certain things that are crimes in other places that are misdemeanors in Georgia and vice versa. But let's just make it simple and say you have to register in another state, and so you're going to have to register in Georgia. You could, in theory, apply immediately to come off the registry in Georgia. There's nothing right now that would stop you from doing that. You would get evaluated for classification upon the application. I think actually, if you move here now, you'll get classified regardless. But if you classify out as a level one and you've already done your sentence is already over, then you could apply immediately in theory in Georgia. There's nothing that stops that in the law.
Thank you for that question. I'm going to move on. That's a great question. Thank you. So the next person up is area code 586. You're on Narsil in Action with Mark Yerchak.
Hi, good evening, folks. I live in Michigan and had my record set aside in 2014, so I have no conviction, but I'm still required to register. And I'm planning to move to Georgia in about 3 or 4 months. How would that be handled there in Georgia, since I don't have a conviction? I'm not sure how they would evaluate.
Well, okay, so let me ask you a question. When you say you don't have a conviction, does that mean that your conviction was somehow expunged or something like that? You did some kind of pretrial diversion type of situation. I don't know what term Michigan uses, but
they have a term called set aside, and it results in, if they complete that period of supervision, then the conviction is not entered. It's set aside. So Michigan has that. They also have the Homeless Youthful Trainee Act, the HYTA. And there's been some litigation about the set aside, but he would have a registration obligation in Georgia by virtue of his registration obligation in Michigan, correct?
That's correct. Yes. I mean, the registration obligation in Michigan would cause registration obligation in Georgia. Georgia would use the term conditional discharge. There's all kinds of different terms used, but I think I get the flavor. Georgia would make you register by virtue of your registration in Michigan. Now, what would be interesting about that is that if Georgia didn't view you as having a conviction because Michigan didn't view you as having a conviction, Georgia has no provision for somebody to register if they are not convicted of certain felonies, which would bring up an interesting question at that point, whether Georgia can actually force someone from out of state to register if they are not technically convicted of any crime, because they wouldn't have to do that in Georgia. You'd set up an equal protection, privileges and immunities type claim. And I've dealt with this a little bit, and I'm actually dealing with this in the courts right now in a different context. But the treatment of out-of-state offenders by the state you're moving to is something I think is kind of unexplored territory, although about a month ago, as I recall, the state of Alaska, once again a trailblazer for sex offender laws, or at least striking down sex offender laws, said that at least part of their sex offender registry statute was unconstitutional because it didn't give incoming alien offenders the opportunity to say that they shouldn't have to register. Now, I think that's something that's also a potentially ripe issue to raise in Georgia as well, and just about anywhere, really, because when you have that blanket requirement, if you have to register in another state, you have to register here, it doesn't account for the possibility that the, for instance, if you get convicted of something that equates to, in Georgia, the crime of sexual battery, simple sexual battery. Well, in Georgia, if you get one conviction of simple sexual battery and it's not a child, then you do not have to register as a sex offender. So if I get convicted in Michigan of something with the same elements and come to Georgia, I should not have to register. That would be my argument. And I think that there would be some sympathetic ears to that in the courts.
I'm going to recommend that that Greg contact your office. That sounds like it would be more detailed than what we can, and we're going to need to speed up our answers just a tad bit because there's 11 people in the queue plus two in YouTube who want to ask a question. Andy, do one of the YouTube questions, please.
Sure. Kiwanis Club said, "I'm a level 2. How difficult is it for him to be removed? Would you have to first be re-leveled, and if so, what's that process?"
Is he a level 2 in Georgia?
Unless the leveling has only recently taken place, you're kind of stuck with that level. Georgia only allows you to seek reclassification within 30 days of the letter they gave you to place you in your level. You 30 days, you get the chance to either ask for reevaluation from SORB or go to the courts to get reevaluation. And then after that, you need to, if you lose with SORB, you can go to the Superior Court. If you lose the Superior Court, you can appeal it, but it's a discretionary appeal. Now, if you're level 2 and you're stuck at level 2, that means that you're going to have to finish your sentence and then wait 10 years. And there's really no way around that in the statute, even for disability, frankly, which seems a little counterintuitive, but that really is the way it works.
So clarify if he's level 2 in Georgia or if he's looking at some other state. In the meantime,
yes, it is Georgia.
In the meantime, I'm going to zip through these calls. Please make your question concise, and let's try to shorten the answers a little bit. Part of what we're doing here is giving Mr. Yurchak exposure so that you can talk to him about your situation if you have nuances like Greg had that would merit a deep dive, but we can't really get into enough details on each person's here. All right, so area code 770, I know this is a Georgia area code. You're on Narsil National, Mark, your check.
Hi, Larry and Mark. This is Brendan Farr with Arsal, Georgia. And my comment is today I attended along with other members of Arsal, Georgia, the Walker versus hearing, and I wanted to get just a few brief.
Excuse me, what case?
It was Walker versus.
It's a removal petition in Fayette County.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So it was a gentleman who was petitioning to be relieved, and one thing that's important to note is that this is a civil petition, it's not a criminal petition. So you'll be doing a civil motion against the state, and that's what he was doing. One thing that was interesting is his offense occurred 12 years ago, and he was yet to be leveled. So he first had to petition back in April for the court to order a leveling because it had gone.
Which they're required to do within 90 days.
Yep. And so they actually did that. So we were there today after that leveling had come back with a risk factor of 1, and he was able to petition. So that was awesome that he was there for that. Now, some takeaways that I got was, one, they brought into the fact that this gentleman had not had a psychosexual evaluation since 2012 because, of course, he wasn't required to other than with probation or other treatment. So they kind of dinged him, the state dinged him, that he didn't know who you were in 2012, but we don't know who you are now. So that's one thing to have in mind. They dinged him for that. Another thing that I noted was the state said, even though you meet the requirement for removal, you're not entitled to removal. And they made that very clear.
That's right. It's all in the judge's discretion.
Yep. So it was up to the judge for that. And I can't stress enough how important it is to get competent legal counsel whenever you go through something like this. This gentleman, Mr. Walker, I was a little nervous with his counsel, to be honest. You know, we were kind of watching the way the counsel was acting and the questions that he was asking of his client up there on the stand. And I was a little nervous. So you want to hire someone that knows what they're doing and has a great track record. You can't just wing this.
Well, thank you, Brendan, for that. That's what we're stressing. And we're stressing about the psychosexual evaluation. You need a current psychosexual evaluation when you initiate this significant. This is a significant change in your life if you don't have to register. Thank you very much, Brent.
I'm sorry to jump in, Larry, but I would disagree that you need one. It's beneficial, but it's not. There's nothing that you actually need to be removed. There's no requirement, but it's exactly what Brendan said. You're going to get dinged on it, and there's got to be some response to that dinging. Now, if you say my client doesn't have enough money, then you potentially could request that of the court to have someone appointed, but then again, I'm probably not representing you if you don't have enough money for an evaluation. I mean, that's just as bluntly as I can put it. That's something, but go ahead.
When I say you need it, it takes away a ding and it takes away an argument. Do you absolutely have to have it? Well, no, you don't have to. You can come out of it with without it and you may succeed. But I try to eliminate as many odds as I possibly can. any obstacles, I mean, as I possibly can. So I would tell people if you're going to file this petition, do it right. Don't do like we had an attorney out of Jonesboro practice law over there in Clayton County for years and years. He had handled his own petition and he got denied, and he had practiced law over there for a long time. just because you're an attorney doesn't mean you know what you're doing. Let's try to expedite these calls. There are still quite a few. Is there another question on YouTube, Andy?
Yes, actually, there's two more. So the next one would be, where'd it go? It says, if someone has a psychosexual evaluation from a licensed therapist they saw for 10 years per terms of probation, can that be used or is a new test required?
Yeah, as we have just discussed, nothing is required. Let's start with that. Second of all, if you have a history of psychosexual evaluations that are all pointing in the right direction for you to be removed, then I would strongly encourage you to bring all of those into your lawyer's office and, you know, drop them right on top of the petition. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of this kind of anything scientific is going to impress the judge because we are not scientists. Lawyers avoided science in school. So when we hear psychiatrists and psychologists and people doing analysis and saying, this is my conclusion, 85% of the lawyers out there really aren't going to have much to say back at the end of that. So, you know, it's great when you have a lot of scientific support and it's not just anecdotal, friends, neighbors, and family saying, you know, this guy deserves a break. So that's absolutely useful. Yes, of course.
So, all right. Well, going to the next caller, I believe this would be from the state of Alabama, 334. You're on Narcissal in Action with Mark Yurchek.
Yes, I'm Debbie with Alabama, and I wanted to ask you to go into more detail with sex offense against a minor and the levels and the assessments that need to be done.
Well, when we're talking about a sex offense against a minor, there's a pretty broad stroke in Georgia is what constitutes that. And a minor in Georgia is defined as under the age of 18, even though the age of consent in Georgia is 16, there's actually a gap there where you you can still have committed a sex offense with a minor who was of age to consent to sex and be able to send nude pictures and stuff. That can still happen. I've seen it happen. Now, you know, in terms of leveling and all that, I emphasize once again that there's not a categorical leveling in Georgia. It is individualized. It's based on the Sexual Offender or Sex Offender Registration Review Board, SORB's, evaluation of you, which is incredibly, incredibly nebulous. And they, in my opinion, they pretty much place you where they want to place you and don't necessarily pay attention to anything that's statistical or actuarial. I've seen that happen many times. They do it by feel, in my opinion, which they should not be doing. And I fought that pretty hard. But for the time being, that's the deal. An offense against a child is treated just like a sex offense against an adult in terms of classification. All the same factors go into it. It's not like they get treated more severely or anything like that.
Thank you for that question, Deborah. Going to move on to area code 424. Please state your question for Mark Yurchek.
Hi there. Good evening, Mark. When it comes to offenders from another country, and that's their state of conviction, and their conviction has been expunged in American terms, and they're not on that foreign country's sex offender registry, but they have to register in America because of that issue from that foreign jurisdiction, how would that affect them in Georgia?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's actually one I've not encountered before, I'll tell you that. But in terms of a foreign conviction, I'm pretty sure that still can cause registration in Georgia, but it would have to meet an elemental test. In other words, I take it back, actually. In Georgia, the registration laws are restricted to an offense under federal law, the laws of another state or territory of the United States. So you would not necessarily have to register in Georgia based on a conviction in a foreign country. I don't think Los Angeles is a foreign country yet. I do love L.A., but if you're calling from 424. But assuming you're not referring to L.A. and are actually talking about a country that is not the United States, that's
a... No, he has a British conviction.
Okay.
From the United Kingdom.
Conviction is British. Or UK. You know, I don't see anything. I mean, I'm just flipping through the statute 42.112 right now that would cause you to have to register, especially if it's been expunged in a foreign country. I don't even know how Georgia will find out about it. Perhaps in a visa application or something. But
They would find out because he's registered in New York, and New York would put a warrant out for him if he did not report into Georgia, if he were to move to Georgia. So that's how they would find out.
Okay, well, you have a lot more information than I do about this particular caller, but I will say, for my part, that I'm not aware that Georgia would make you register because of a conviction in a foreign country. From that standpoint, you'd have to tell me that they told you that, that it would be a more fact-specific question or situation. So,
I would encourage Charles. Charles, I would encourage you to reach out. But he has a United Kingdom conviction, and he is required to register in New York. So they would to not have a warrant, he would have to register in Georgia.
Okay, well, you crept up on me with less than all the facts. But if Charles wants to talk to me about the specifics, I'm more than happy to do that.
We're going to give your number out here toward the end of the hour. We're going to try to zip through a few more calls. You're on Arsenal in Action with Mark Yurchek, and I know who this is. Go ahead.
Hi there. Am I on?
You're on. Go ahead.
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm calling from a foreign jurisdiction. It's more of an academic question. I'm not contemplating moving to Georgia, but you indicated earlier that if one were to apply for removal from the registration, the judges would look favorably on an apology from the applicant. What does an applicant do who is convicted of an offense but hasn't committed an offense? This is a real problem where I live.
Okay, I would immediately I don't know about where you live, but here I would immediately tell you not to say anything that's not in your heart. And I mean, I simply brought that up anecdotally as the level of discretion judges have, and I do not agree with it. I was frankly a bit offended by the way the judge treated that. Situation. So, I mean, I'm going to be the last person that's going to tell you I can get up there and apologize for something that you don't believe you did. And, you know, I don't mean by anything I said to imply that that is the case. So.
All right. So, area code 630, you're on Arsenal in Action with Mark Yurchek.
Great. Thank you so much. Quick question then. Illinois, lifetime registration, up, it'll be 10 years next year. If I move to Georgia, establish residency, and register, certainly, and am fortunate enough to be removed, if I move to another state or perhaps even back to Illinois, do I have to register?
Well, I'm not going to speak to Illinois because that's kind of a weird situation where you had to register there previously, came, left the jurisdiction, and presumably do not have to register anymore. Stayed in Georgia for a little while, idled, and then went back to Illinois. And your question is, do I have to register? I'm not going to answer for that one. But as any other state, if Illinois is the only place where you have to register, you leave Illinois, move to Georgia, are able to come off, and Illinois suddenly is no longer where you have to register, then it's still going to be state by state because they could say if you were convicted in a foreign jurisdiction of X crime, then you have to register. But you're not going to have to register by virtue of the fact that you have to register in another jurisdiction, depending on the language. Now, if they use like present tense language, you know, an offender who's been who has to register, right? In Georgia, it's a non-resident who changes residence from another state or territory of the United States or any other place to Georgia who's required to register as a sexual offender under federal law, military law, tribal law, or the laws of another state or territory, or who has been convicted in the state of criminal offense against a victim who's minor. You wouldn't be required to register in Georgia because you have to register somewhere else if you had gone to a third place first. And I'm getting a little complex with my response, but essentially, I think most states are keen to catch on to, you know, different tricks you can try. But I think, you know, if you've been convicted of a crime in another jurisdiction that at least arguably is subject to registration, even if you come off of the registry in some second place and try to then move on to a third location or back to the first location, I think you're still going to have to take a hard look at it to see whether or not you're compelled to register. I don't think that's going to really work in most situations.
I would echo that more succinctly, that Georgia can only release you from Georgia. If you go to Nevada and they reach back to 1970, Georgia releases you. Doesn't control Nevada. If you took your card that you were exempt from having an admissions inspection to New Jersey and you said I'm exempt, it wouldn't be binding on New Jersey. I'm going to do a favor, Janice. I know you're here, and if you have a few words to say, I'm going to unmute you because we're running out of time this hour, and I never want to overlook Janice. So, Janice, you're on Arsenal in Action. Janice is a practicing attorney who heads up an organization that does the same work called Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws. And we are going to be in a break in just a couple of minutes. So, Janice, I don't want to leave you out. So, you have anything to add?
Yes, I do, of course. So, attorneys can always talk. Just be really careful when you move from one state to another. And there are some states out there that are kind of like flypaper, and you don't want to get registered in those states if you can possibly avoid it. New York is one of them, and certainly Florida is another, but there are many others out there. And what I mean by that is if you are end up registering in one of those states, you're on that registry for life, regardless of whether or not you have to register even in your home state. And some people are confused, and they think, oh, I just went to Florida for a week, went to Disney, and did that. And because they think because they're not registering each and every year, renewing their registration, that they're not registered there. And that is not the case, literally. And well, it's really important, Larry and everybody listening, when it comes to the International Megan's Law and whether or not you have to have the unique identifier put on your passport. So people who, the unique identifier only goes on the passports of people, one, convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and two, who are currently required to register somewhere on any state. And I know California, we're looking forward to the year 2021 when our tiered registry goes into effect, but I am concerned for people in California, but for people in other states as well, that if you're registered in multiple states, even involuntarily, that the unique identifier is going to be added to your passport.
Well, I'd also, just to piggyback off of what Janice said, please keep in mind as well that all this hopping between states has a potential consequence as well, because I know I've encountered at least one case in Georgia where Georgia didn't let a guy that talked to me off the registry because they said he was subject to SORNA for moving state to state, and therefore couldn't come off the federal registry, so they weren't going to let him off Georgia either. And I know there's we could do another hour on SORNA, but you know that is something that I don't think is only going to come up in Georgia as far as an issue.
We are going to we're going to pause for this hour. Janice, I'm going to invite you, if you have the ability in your schedule, you can hang on with us for the second hour and participate in Can They Do That? And if depending on how many callers there are in the queue, we can expand on what's been discussed, because I would like to do a program about the California removal process that's going to take effect. So, Mark, how do people contact you? Give your phone number and how to contact you, and then we're going to take a 4 or 5 minute break. So go ahead.
Sure. So my name is Mark Yurachek. My last name is spelled Yurachek. You can find me. My firm's website is www.myappealslawyer.com. That's MyAppeals Lawyer.com. You can reach my office at area code 470-319-8721, or you can email me at mark@myappealslawyer.com. And also follow me on Twitter at Mayfirm, M-A-Y Firm.
Thank you so much, okay. Mark. And everybody, we're going to be back in 4 minutes, and we'll resume the second hour of the program. You are listening to NARSL in Action.
In reality,
thank you for time, Larry.
We live in a different climate that is hostile to the notion of substantive rights, by and large. Good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not here to offer an opinion on whether that's good judging or bad. I'm just noticing that it's true. If you go to the Supreme Court today and say, I have a substantive right, and you cannot point to a specific word in the Constitution that gives it to you, you will lose. That might not be true 10 years ago, 10 years from now. It wasn't true in the 60s and 70s, but it sure as heck true now, right? If you go to the Supreme Court and say, I have a constitutional fundamental right to travel around a state freely, they will say, show me, you won't do it, and you will lose.
Registry Matters is a podcast that gives you the deep insights and analysis of what is going on within the registry. But it's more than that. It peels back the layers from what is obvious on the surface, the hidden traps and tricks of how you can create significant change. Do you believe that the registry is unconstitutional? If your answer is yes, and I believe the answer is yes, each of us needs to stop waiting for someone else to do it, and we need to step up to the plate. Take a swing. Each episode is a deep dive into how we, yes, we can make changes. We can't sit by and wait for other people to do it. We are the ones. We need you, all of you, to step up and speak out. But wait, do what? Listen to each episode to learn how to be empowered to affect change for each of us and for our families that are affected by the registry. For more information, visit registrymatters.co or search Registry Matters where you listen to your favorite podcasts.
And, oh, by the way, the internet is nothing. It doesn't mean anything. In a wonderful opinion written this last spring out of Kansas, a Supreme Court justice in dissent said, you know, I don't know that those justices in 2003, many of whom by that point were well in their 60s, even understood the implication of the internet. I don't know that they really knew what they were actually crafting and the devastation that it was going to follow for them. Maybe the current U.S. Supreme Court will understand that it isn't the same thing as having a public notification of your conviction. You can't get off the registry, and even if you could get off the registry, that follows you and dogs you on the internet for life. And the way the registries look on the internet, you don't even know half the time what the offense was. You just see the label. You see the name of the tier.
Hi, this is Brenda Jones, NARSOL Executive Director. If you're hearing this, you know just how important our work is to citizens across this country who struggle daily with the challenges of being on a public registry. You know what it means to wear that scarlet letter or to have a loved one wearing it. NARSOL is fighting for the rights of millions of registrants, their family members, and their children to live free of excessive repressive laws that keep on punishing long after their sentences are over. We are filing lawsuits challenging restrictions, and our volunteers are fighting in state capitals not only to prevent new bad laws, but also to introduce positive change. We need you to continue our work. Have you joined us yet? Made a contribution? Go to NARSOL.org today, that's NARSOL.org, and click on Join or Donate. Do it today before you forget. Become a part of NARSOL's fight for your rights.
Please keep in mind, responses provided on the program are merely intended to offer guidance and should not be construed as legal advice. We cannot cover the specifics of any individual situation sufficiently to know what the most prudent course of action is, so NARSOL advises all participants to consult with an attorney in their jurisdiction to determine the best course of action.
So welcome back, everyone. We're beginning our final hour of tonight's program. We're only doing 2 hours tonight. I'm getting too old for these long programs. For this second hour, we're going to have we're going to do an update on New Mexico. We're going to have Can They Do That? And we'll try to take those questions that were still hanging in the queue, if they're still there, that didn't manage to get into the last hour. But let me introduce our guest, our official guest, and then our impromptu guest. Ashley Cloud is a former assistant district attorney in the state of New Mexico in the 13th Judicial District Attorney's Office. She has left the prosecution side and has joined the defense and works as a staff attorney for a Liberty and Justice Coalition in New Mexico. She spent the better part of her 25-year career as a prosecutor, and she prosecuted everything. To make the list short, she did everything from murder down the gamut of prosecutions, and she has extensive knowledge in forensics and cybersecurity. Ashley, welcome to the second time I think you've been with us. Is Ashley with us? Is anybody
she is not
with
here.
Us?
No, she is not in the voice channel, so Ashley is not with us at the moment.
Well, then it's a good thing we have a backup guest. So, and for those of you who heard the tail end of the previous hour, we have invited Janice Bellucci to join us. Janice is, I can't keep title, but keep track of the title. She's either the president or the executive director or some aficionado of the Alliance for Constitutional Sexual Offense Laws. She's an attorney, and she's been with us off and on through the years. And Janice, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here, Larry.
Thank you. See, you saved me tonight. I don't have to monologue for an hour. So
happy to do it.
We were going to talk about a brief overview of New Mexico's upcoming litigation, which I guess if people can stand me, I can do it. And I don't know what happened to Ashley. She's two offices down from me, and we can't see each other. Ashley, hopefully you make your way back to the program. Janice, did you want to say anything about yourself or Axel or anything before we go to these questions? I know that you have been in the trenches now for I met you at the New Mexico conference, and that was 2012. So I know you've been in the trenches for a long time.
I have. It's probably been close to 10 years now. And I am the founder of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, otherwise known as ACSOL, A-C-S-O-L. And I am the past president and the current executive director of the organization. And we made that change because I really deal with the day-to-day operations and of the organization. And what that means is I'm talking to people on the registry every single day. That's what I do. And I help those that can be helped, and others I do refer to attorneys, like the gentleman who was just helping us in Georgia. So our organization is very litigation-focused, I guess I could put it that way. And I'm getting close to my 100th lawsuit here in California. So we have... We focused on what we thought were the lowest hanging fruits in California. And for us, that was getting rid of something called presence restrictions. Some states call them proximity restrictions. But it's basically where a registrant can visit. And we're not talking about where they can live, but where they can visit. So when we started that campaign out, we had 79 cities and a few counties that had prohibitions about where somebody on the registry could visit. And there were never any sign requirements, so you could very simply bumble into a situation, as did one gentleman when he went to visit a park in the city of Pasadena, not knowing that they had presence restrictions, and the next thing he knew, he was being arrested for violating the law. And again, he was in a public park. That day was a beautiful day. He was taking pictures of flowers and trees, and the next thing he knew, he was put in handcuffs and dragged off to L.A. County Jail. So we were eventually able to help him and get off of on from under those charges. So we got rid of all the presence restrictions in the state of California. And by the way, that included going to visit museums, going to the beaches, dog parks, et cetera, et cetera. The only people now in California that have to deal with presence restrictions are those on parole or probation. So that was really important to us to get that done. We have had three successful lawsuits challenging Halloween restrictions, and that was important as well, when in fact the government was requiring people on the registry to identify themselves publicly as being on the registry. And it was so bad, who supervised registrants on parole, that they basically said that anybody who was on parole was going to have to put a sign anywhere where they lived. And, you know, okay, you can think about a single family home or maybe a condo or apartment. You keep going down the food chain, mobile homes, et cetera, all the way down to if you lived in your car, you're going to have to put a sign on the windshield of your car. And if you lived in a tent, on the flap of your tent. And finally, if you were sleeping in a sleeping bag on the ground because you're homeless, they were telling the registrants on parole they were going to have to put a sign on their sleeping bag, which makes absolutely no sense, because what parent in the right mind would go to a gentleman or a woman, for that matter, lying on the ground in a sleeping bag and asking them for a trick or treat? So, so we got rid of those. And now our current campaign really has to do is focus on residency restrictions. So we started out with fewer residency restrictions of presence restrictions, but it's been harder to get rid of them. And a couple of city attorneys or law firms representing cities broke the code for us and said, look, you know, there's just too much public pressure, perceived public pressure on residency restrictions. And oh, by the way, if we get rid of our residency restrictions, the next town over is going to send all their, you know, registrants to our town. Well, we're 37 lawsuits into it, and we're pretty close. When I think we only have about 10 more cities that have residency restrictions. And we were assisted, by the way, with a state Supreme Court decision that said that they were unconstitutional. And the crazy thing is, even with the state Supreme Court decision, maybe not so crazy to Michigan, with the Sixth Circuit, but despite that, the cities would not let go of their residency restrictions. So we did exactly what they invited us to do, which is we sued them. So we've gotten rid of probably now about 33 of them. Yes.
Janice, thank you for that. I mean, you guys are doing phenomenal work out there. And we're going to, we've managed to get Ashley back. Ashley, are you here?
Oh, very good.
Is Ashley here with us?
Yes.
Ashley, nice to have you back.
I'm back.
I've done the introduction, and we're trying to compress the focus on New Mexico because we're going to do a separate call. But we're about to launch a lawsuit here. So rather than talking about all the lawsuits we're going to do of our priorities, why don't we talk about the one that's fairly imminent in terms of the out of state, those who have convictions arising in out of states. What is that litigation all about?
We are actually getting ready. I think we have a good base of plaintiffs identified, or we're in the final stages of that, where we're going to do a very limited scope of litigation to enforce a due process that should already be taking place for anybody moving here from out of state. We're not seeking to get people removed off the registry. We are not seeking to have any of the actual translations done. What we're seeking in this particular litigation is just the due process. The other ones we will do in stages, but this is the first stage of it. And I think we're pretty close to launching, aren't we, Larry?
I'm hoping that we get it launched in the month of September. We have a nuance in our law that says it has to be required. If you come here with a conviction from another state, it has to be equivalent to one of ours, not substantially similar, not anything other than equivalent. And our state Supreme Court has said that there has to be a process. And they said that in 2011. And here we are 8 years later, and we have hundreds of people that are categorized as awaiting a translation. And we're going to try to move that process along, that these people have an individualized examination and they have the opportunity to participate in whether or not they should be registered at all. If it is, in fact, not equivalent, they should have not been on the registry. But if it is equivalent, is it equivalent to one of our shorter term registration periods, or is it a 20 year, or is it a lifetime? So we're going to have a little bit of fun with that, because the state Supreme Court has already decreed this and they just haven't been doing it. Janice, can they do that? Is questions about things that are being required that may not be permissible if there were to be a challenge. And we end up telling everybody, yes, they can do it until they're stopped. But what we hope to flush out is if there would be a viable cause of action underneath whatever the person alleges that's happening when they say, can they do this? And we've gone the gamut through things that you can't even imagine that people come up with. So there's one person left over in the queue. I'm going to go to you. And then anybody who has a question for Janice or Ashley, this is kind of open forum, but please don't tell the story. Let's try to confine it to a question on can they do that? So star 6 will get you into the queue. And I'm going to take the person who's been holding forever and ever and see area code 610. You're on with Janice Bellucci and Ashley Cloud.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm outside of Pennsylvania and outside of Philadelphia. I was charged on one count of invasion of privacy with no minors involved. And it's an isolated incident, only offense. And I was also deemed an SVP, and it was a misdemeanor level crime. And it's not considered an illegal sentence in the state of Pennsylvania. So my question is, with all that being said, is there some kind of new avenue that I could possibly take to possibly petition for removal?
I'm sorry, it wasn't involving a minor, and they're still labeling you an SVP and requiring you to register?
Yes, I have to register for life, do polygraph testing for life, treatment for life. And there was no minors or children involved. One incident in my own home involving a cell phone. Nobody was underage.
Actually, let me, if you don't mind, I'm trying to compress time. For an SVP in Pennsylvania, you can complete your supervision, but as a result of that designation, they still impose requirements on you, because It's a nuance of their law, but I don't think either of our guests are particularly qualified in terms of helping you. Qualified is not the right word. Up to date on Pennsylvania law in terms of what you might be able to seek in way of a remedy. I mean, I know Ashley's not, and I don't know if Janice. How do you feel about opining on Pennsylvania law?
Yeah, I don't feel qualified to answer that, but there's got to be a good attorney from Pennsylvania out there because that's abominable.
We have, and my age is showing here. I can't remember. We had a magnificent attorney that attended our conference. And Andy, if you could be so kind as to give her a shout out, because I think that would be the first place to stop was the person who was at the Cleveland conference from Pennsylvania. And Andy's also having old timers.
I just don't know. I wasn't paying attention. I have other things going on.
I was asking about the Pennsylvania attorney that we had at the Cleveland conference, whose name is escaping me because of my age.
I am at a loss then. Sorry. Okay. Maybe Brenda gives it to me, I'll get it to you.
So, okay. But yes, I'm going to write down his telephone number. We can pass that on to you. And we actually do pass stuff on to you. So I got the 610 number you're calling from. If that's a good number,
I appreciate it.
We will make the referral to you. And you said your name was Mike?
Yes.
Correct? Okay. So PA attorney. Okay. All right, Mike. Thank you for that. And thanks for listening and supporting us. All right. So *6 will get you in the queue. And area code 352, you're on NARSL in action with Janice Bellucci and Ashley Cloud.
Good evening, Larry. It's Mike from last month's call as well down here in Florida. My question is, and I guess for the gentleman in 610, Larry will follow up with you. He did with me and he will with you. So just be confident in that. My question is, I'm in Florida on an interstate compact from Georgia, still on probation, but yet they completely deny us access to the internet in any way, shape, or form. And can they do that, or how can we fight that?
So this is an area that's near and dear to Larry's and mine's heart right now. So yes, they can impose conditions on you in the state that you're in, even if they weren't conditions in Georgia. And I'm well aware of what the contract is in Georgia and what the differences are in Florida as well. So yes, they can. And the only challenge to be made is if somebody in Florida attacks the actual probation conditions as being too restrictive, given the nature of the crime. If it's a blanket imposition, there's a way to attack it. I'm not sure how successful it would be, but that would be the only avenue. But until then, yes, they can do that.
Janice?
And do you see any glimmer of hope in the North Carolina or any of those Supreme Court decisions?
I agree with Ashley. And I think maybe some of the confusion that comes about, I don't know, from the gentleman who just called in or from others, is about the Packingham case, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision. And just I hope everybody remembers that the Packingham case has to do with using social media. It really isn't, doesn't make a decision with regard to who actually has connection to the internet. And as Ashley just said, I know it's true in California as well, that if your offense included use of a computer, you're less likely to be able to use a computer while you're on parole or probation. It's not an absolute ban. It really depends a lot on the parole or probation officer. And the other thing is it's more likely that you can use a computer if, in fact, you agree to have it monitored. And they do the monitor in real time. So if you are being denied access, you might try that with your PO. And ask him, could you do it if you agree to monitor?
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, for your support. Thanks. We are going to give out this famous phone number, if I can find it. I usually remember it, but boy, my memory's going downhill. 747-227-4477. That's area code 747-227-4477. That is for your contest, so text Andy. Contest, because shortly after when we get to the bottom of the hour, I'm going to ask for a prize selection. So please enter now if you're going to. Andy, what do you have, 150 entries right now?
Totally. Absolutely.
That's everybody
in my spreadsheet.
Everybody who signed up for the call is entered. So seriously, text contest, and he will text you back a contestant number, and we'll draw that number shortly after the bottom of this hour.
Hey, Larry, the attorney's name was Leah Bickerton.
Leah Bickerton. Well, then I will say on the line, it's Leah, LeahBickerton, and she's based in the Pittsburgh area. And very, very, very good and tenacious. So we can suggest that you contact Leah Bickerton. Is everybody in YouTube? Because I've got a string of people here in Star 6 that have questions.
I do have a question from over there, too. You ready for
it? Okay, well, let's do the YouTube.
All right, this is from Howard. It says, I was registered in 2000 for sex abuse. I also have the papers that say I was supposed to have been released from it in 10 years, yet I'm still required to register. I want off the registry. How do I do that? I'm in Indiana, but was convicted in Kentucky.
I hear crickets.
So I don't know what the policies are in Indiana for the out-of-state convictions. I think... if memory serves me correctly, they're one of the more stricter states, but I would reach out to Larry. Feel free to jump in here because this is like an area of expertise for you, but I would actually reach out to either the petition, the court where you're living, stating that you're due to be off the registry, or if it's the Department of Public Safety that's actually overseeing it, I would start with them. It depends on the registry scheme there. I can tell you what we would do here, but I'm not sure about Indiana.
Well, we have the beauty of this live forum is that we have a listening audience, and we have a listener who's just popped in from Indiana, and we're going to go to him for just a second. And if we can't resolve it without spending a whole bunch of time, I will actually follow up with the person in terms of more detail, because there's some cases out of Indiana, one very recently in the U.S. District Court. So I'm going to go to Michael from Indiana. Did you have something to add?
Yeah. Hi, Larry. It's Michael. In Indiana, there is also a provision for removal of the SVP status, which if you're a lifetime registrant in Indiana, that's probably what you have. After 10 years on the registry, you can petition the court for removal of the status, which would then get you off the registry because it's only a 10-year requirement if you're not an SVP or a lifetime registrant.
And Michael, thank you for that. Do you petition the court where you're at, or is there a different provision in that statute? Do you know?
No, it's the court where you are required to register. The code is 11-8-8-22.
Andy, will you?
The IC code, IC code under which the petition is 11-8-8-22.
Andy, will you retrieve the phone number from the YouTube, and that we can begin by connecting him with Michael, and then we'll go from there. I know this is not what Michael normally does, but he was nice enough to jump in here and help us, and we may be able to get the guy some answer, or at least to a legal resource that would be helpful to him.
Got it.
He's welcome to call me too, Larry. My direct dial number is 317-662-0250. 317-662-0250.
So thanks, Michael. And jump back in here if you have anything else. Thanks for the help.
Okay.
So
thanks.
So all right. So now let's start moving through the calls. There's a half a dozen of them here. Star 6 will get you in the queue. Area code 205, which I think is in Alabama, in the Birmingham, Northern Alabama area, or at least Central Alabama. You're on Northland Action with Ashley Cloud and Janice Bellucci.
Yes, I got a general question. It's about federal. Just want to make a quick statement. A lot of this is just like spider webs. It's all so confusing, and it seems like the laws and the municipalities, cities, states, and counties are all confused as well. Hopefully one day that'll be the implosion of all this. But real quick, on federal, I registered before I served time. I'm on probation now, and on the federal, it's 15 years. And my question is, since I registered before I served time, does that count from the time I registered for the 15 years?
I love that question because the answer is it might, and it probably doesn't. But keep in mind there is no federal registry, so you registered with a state registry wherever you registered at. But Ashley or Janice, do you want to opine on that? Where this is headed is Alabama's lifetime, and the federal guidelines for his offense, it's probably possession, would be a 15-year tier one. So he's wanting to know which controls. And of course, I know the answer, but I'll let you guys tell him which controls.
Janice, do you want to jump in, or you want me to jump in?
Sure. I'll take the first swipe at it, and you can have to do it. It's states registered people, and the federal government does not. The federal government has guidelines, but they don't control who has to register and how long they have to register. So I know there's a lot of confusion about that. There's a federal law out there, SORNA, but many states are not compliant. Last time I checked, I think only 17 states were even partially compliant, and I know California is not. So in California, for example, if you register, you basically are signed up for life until our QID registry goes into effect.
So Alabama caller, as long as you're in Alabama, you're going to have to register under that lifetime. Either Alabama will be forced to change it by the litigation. There's litigation, I think, in the 11th Circuit still hasn't been decided, the case of McGuire. But until Alabama is forced to, I don't foresee them bringing those requirements down, because they would think that it was going to invite people to come from other states that have tougher requirements. So unfortunately, you're doomed. In Alabama, that lifetime registration is what they're going to require as long as you're there. So I think he went silent. But anyway, thanks for support listening to us.
I'm good.
I hope that helps you. Okay.
Yeah, I was just.
Whoops, a little too quick on the trigger. Got you back. Did you have one final comment to make?
Well, yeah, I already understood that on the state, how the state is. All tiers is three tier. No matter where you land, it's all life. But I was just concerned on the federal end on that because of moving out of the country.
If you move out of the country, it's going to be specific to whatever country. If they have a registry, the feds won't have any more control over you if you leave the country in terms of enforcing a registration requirement. But whatever state you go to, you're going to have to register in compliance with their laws, regardless of what the Adam Walsh Act recommendations is, Janice. But those are recommendations. The states can go beyond those, and many have, who have implemented their own version of the Adam Walsh Act. They have gone beyond what's required, and they can do that as long as they meet the minimums. So thank you, sir.
Larry, there's something I'd like to add real quickly, because I just heard that gentleman mention about moving outside of the country. And unfortunately, in some of those states, and I've mentioned two of them, and Florida and New York, even if you move out of the country, you're still registered in those states.
Well, and when you say registered, you're still listed on the internet. They don't require you to report in to be fingerprinted, photographed, and to do anything, but you're still listed, correct?
Yes.
So
let me qualify. For the purposes of the international maintenance law, you're still required to register.
But
I will say that California is not that way, and neither is California.
So we're gonna pause for the drawing. Did you receive any more entries, Andy?
I think we're good.
Did any more people text when I gave the final opportunity?
Yes, I've had four in the last 5 minutes.
All right. Well, we're gonna have the computer assign a random contestant number, which Andy's about to announce.
Give me a moment to randomize everything. I'll do that more than once to make sure that's good and randomized. Do you want to pick a first digit? Do you want to get to the drum roll, or should I do the drum roll?
I don't think you have a drum roll. I'll do the drum roll. Just go ahead.
All right. The number is 5492. If you have 5492, please send me a text message so that I know that it is you. And I will match it up with your phone number and all those things so that we can award you that prize.
So text winner to Andy.
That'll do.
All right. So All right, we're going to take some more phone calls because they're stacked up here, and hopefully we have a winner. If no one texts in the coming moments, we will move on and select another. So area code 908. I have no idea where that is. You're on Narsal in Action with Ashley and Janice.
How y'all doing?
Go ahead.
My question is, when in New Jersey, I'm from New Jersey, and it said that you got 15 years, you could challenge your CSL or Megan's local eviction after your conviction or release from prison, whichever is later. I get lawyers saying that I can challenge it because it's 15 years from my conviction, judgment of conviction. And then you get some say, well, you got to be out 15 years before you can challenge it. Do you have like any clue about that or what I should go on?
When he said CSL, he means community supervision for life. But I don't know anything. Janice, I know Ashley and I have never talked about New Jersey. So,
yeah, I don't have anything to say.
Yeah, because it's New Jersey. It's kind of like they could play with the wording, and it says from conviction or 15 years from release, whichever is later. When they say whichever is later, you get different lawyers say, oh, well, you can challenge it. And then you get some say, well, you can't challenge it. Hang up on you. And my case happened in 96, sentence in 98, and I've been on CSL now for 11 years. So we're talking about something happened almost 22, 23 years ago. And no new charges. I've been, I just don't know what to do.
Have you spoken to an attorney named Maynard, last name Maynard? I believe he practices in New Jersey.
Out of Morristown. Yeah, out of Morristown. I've just heard of him not too long ago.
Have you made contact with him? Because that would be the first person that would come to my mind.
No, I have seen that he was in one of your conventions. I've seen him in a lineup from New Jersey, and that's where I had got the information from. But I haven't called him.
Oh, well, we really don't have enough information to be helpful to you. I mean, it sounds on the face of it, whichever comes later would be, but I'm not going to take a dare because I've never done anything in New Jersey.
All right. Well, thank you. I thank you for what y'all do. I'm a supporter, Legacy Matters, and also just keep doing what y'all doing, and God bless y'all.
Thank you, sir. All right. Midshipman, you're on Narsal in Action with Janice and hopefully Ashley. I think we've lost communication with Ashley at the moment, but Midshipman, go ahead.
Hello, Sarah. Thank you very much for having me. So this is actually my first exposure to Narsal. I was actually invited to listen in on this conversation. This is also the state of Texas I'm in right now. Now, kind of a couple things. Two quick questions, hopefully. One is very simple. If I want to learn more and I want to volunteer, like, what number on your website do I need to call, and who do I need to find?
We actually have a volunteer tab on the Narsal website for you fill out an application if you're talking about volunteering for Narsal, and that'll give us the contact information and what you're interested in doing, and then the volunteer coordinator will reach out to you by email first, and then he will direct you to a real person once we figure out what it is that you want to do. Some of the jobs that people want to do don't exist. We don't have a lot of envelope stuffing to be done, and people say, I can do that. So depending on what you want to do, we would try to match you up with what interests you.
Okay, and then I guess more important to me in particular, if I'm trying to get some referrals to legal counsel here in Texas, is there another, spot on the website or a number to call for assistance with that?
I think probably a great resource is going to be the Texas Voices Group, and they're going to have a conference called Thursday night, which they're putting together. I believe it's this Thursday night, where they're going to have an attorney who specializes. The specific purpose is removal, the petition process they have in Texas. But Texas Voices has a fairly robust state group there, and that would be where I would recommend that you start. So, Midshipman, is that helpful? Thank you.
I muted him just for a moment.
So yeah, it was a lot of rumble coming from the background, but I think that was the end of his question. So star 6 will get you in the queue. And we got area code 484. You're on Narsil in Action with Ashley and Janice.
Yes, my question was, does a state Supreme Court ruling is the final controlling authority, or could it become a federal issue over and above the state Supreme Court? And if so, whose responsibility is it to remove the folks from the list for a registry? Is it the Pennsylvania State Police, Board of Parole and Pardons, or does one have to go to court to get it?
So I hear crickets. He's calling from Pennsylvania. The answer is very clearly that the state Supreme Court controls when they're interpreting state law, and the federal courts interpret when they're control when they're interpreting the federal Constitution and federal law. The state Supreme Court has resoundingly ruled in Pennsylvania that people are going to get relief from the registry. I'm not up to date enough to know where the process is in terms of what relief is flowing to people. I know the public defender of Philadelphia had a lot to do with that litigation. Leah Bickerton, who we mentioned earlier, she has tracked this litigation. And in terms of how you would go about getting the particular relief you may be entitled to, I would suggest contacting Leah Bickerton and find out, or either the Defender Association of Philadelphia, which they may have a Q&A on their website, because they would be getting deluged with phone calls, and they may not have the resources to take those phone calls.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you for listening.
I just am glad that there is someone out there that we can do these kind of calls and get general feelings about issues. And I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for supporting us, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to area code 231. You're all with Ashley and Janice. And this is supposed to be, can they do that? But it looks like we're going in other directions, which is fine. And you've got a lot of background noise. So please state your question.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to have to mute the mic.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get away from children. I have a question. I didn't know if y'all are familiar with this particular case because my question is kind of along it. But I want to say that the case was a case in the Mariana Islands, which I think are a territory. They draw on the U.S. Constitution. But anyways, again, I'm sorry. I have a toddler who won't leave me alone. Anyways, the case was I think it was a girlfriend, and she was challenging the constitutionality of them being able to say that her children's father couldn't live with them because he was a convicted sex offender, and basically challenging that it infringed upon her constitutional rights as a mother. It's also a tactic that I'm interested in possibly exploring, the constitutionality of infringing on a mother's parental rights, ostensibly to protect children. And I just didn't know if anybody knew anything about that case or if anybody had even ever thought along these lines, but it's something I think about.
So I've definitely thought along those lines. I'm not familiar with that particular case, and I would actually be interested in looking into that a bit more, but it is something that I've looked at, because including like on probation, and then we've expanded it. We've seen recent House bills in certain states that expanded into custody situations and family court and everything else. And so we're seeing it getting broader and broader, and this concerns me. I think it concerns Larry as well, and I'm sure a lot of people. But it's definitely something that we've considered, because I actually want to do challenges on undisclosed romantic relationships and certain other things that actually have been challenged, I think, in California, Janice, as well.
Yeah, we have a case here in the Ninth Circuit that was decided by the Ninth Circuit called United States versus Wolfchild. And in that case, it basically said that a person on the registry has the right to visit with their children, their biological children, and visit their
unless they visit, and possibly even to live with their biological children, provided that the child was not the victim of their offense. Now, I know in California, our Department of Corrections is busily trying to whittle away at that, and they'll come up with these clever ideas, which is that as long as the victim was a relative, then you couldn't have access. But I don't think that's right. That interpretation is correct. But at least know that in the Ninth Circuit, and I don't know if Mariana Islands is within the Ninth Circuit or not. I'm kind of thinking it might be, but I'm not staring at a computer to tell you that for sure. But that United States versus what child decision might help.
Oh, and I apologize
okay, thank
for
you.
The call.
I mean,
right. Yeah, so I had muted because of the noise. But yes, we're not familiar with the case, but we're familiar with the issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Larry, I do have to depart. I wasn't planning to spend this entire time on the call. I've got to go.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Janice, for being with us as long as you've been.
You're welcome.
Here. So Janice, you know what? I would like to do a California removal case, a call similar to what we did now in terms of how this removal process is going to work, because I think from what I've read,
okay,
it's the most disgusting process I've ever seen designed in terms of it. And I'm thinking it's going to be very,
okay.
I don't think a soul is ever going to get off it. So it was designed so poorly, but I'm hoping I'm wrong, and I'm hoping that a lot of people get off, but I'd like to go do a deep dive into the removal process.
Well, I'll talk to you about it offline. Bye-bye.
All
and
right,
Janice, I just want to thank you for all the work that you're doing out there. I do keep apprised of a lot of the California stuff, so thank you. I appreciate it.
So good night, Janice. Oh, area code 847, you're on with Ashley. Can they do that? Area code 847, are you with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. No, this is Tom. Kind of dreaming here for a minute. I'm in Illinois. Did this little background information. I'm 81 years old, by the way, and married. My wife and I have been married for 60 years. We have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, etc. I am on the registration. I was arrested back in 2006 and charged with possession. And my case festered in our local court for actually 3 years, primarily because I was at that point a former mayor and very active. I was the chairman of the Republican Party in our county, a number of other things, and most of the judges opted not to want to listen to my case. We finally had to go outside of our judicial district, bring someone in, and that person promptly retired and moved to California. So it took, it was not until 3 years later, in 2009, that my case was adjudicated, and I was found guilty of possession and charged with a short period of time in the county jail and a six-month probation and a fine, and at that time, I was advised that I would have to be on the registration for a period of 10 years. And shortly afterwards, our state legislature modified the legislation, and my attorney, I think about five or six weeks after I was involved in the final process, notified me that, unfortunately, instead of being on the registration for a period of the time mentioned, I would be on it for a lifetime. And needless to say,
is that your question? Because we're really up against the clock here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Is that your question?
My question is, how do I try to get off of it, if it's possible? Since I was originally supposed to be on for a period of 10 years, and I've now gone past that period of time, and how do I apply, or what process would I take to try to get off of the registration completely?
Well, what you would do is you would contact a legal professional in the state of Illinois, and you would possibly contact Scott, who was on earlier, and gave out his number. And there have been a number of cases in Illinois. You said Indiana or Illinois?
No, it's Illinois.
Did you? Okay. So then I'm giving you bad advice. Then it's not Scott for Illinois.
We have Scott here who is active in our county or in our state organization, but probably someone different. Go ahead.
So, but I mean, you raise a great point. What happened to you happens to a lot of folks. As long as the registration has not been declared punitive, the statutes can be changed because they can extend the period of the regulatory application. So the people have been trapped all over the country. Their counsel advised them that they would be registering for 10 years, and that was correct advice at the time. Sometimes it wasn't correct. It was actually wrong at the time it was given. But assuming that advice was correct at the time it was given, then the attorney couldn't have anticipated with any type of crystal ball what they might do in changing the law. So they changed the law, and until the courts declare that the Illinois registration requirement is sufficiently debilitating that it imposes punishment, that change is accepted as constitutional, and it's merely regulatory in nature. It's not intended to punish you. There's a lot of litigation going on in Illinois. Adele Nicholas and Mark Weinberg, they've been litigating consistently, and I would say they would be great resources to ask about what relief you might be able to get with
them. I may pursue that. One of my good friends and associates is a very active attorney here in our area as it is, and I have good resources from that standpoint. And of course, the whole issue of an ex post facto change, constitutional change issue, has come up a number of times. But I've not pursued it from that point of view. Fortunately, even though it's a pain in the neck, to say the least. I live a very reasonable life, and they're married and have children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, what have you, and a lot of good friends and what have you. So I have no risk required. No, I'm not impugned at all regarding where I live. I actually border a park, but because my house was, we moved into it in 1998, it preceded any legislation.
We're going to have to cut you off here, sir. I'm up against the clock. Thank you for support. All right. Area code 505. That's a familiar area code. You're on with Ashley.
Hi, yes. My question is for Ashley. My conviction was before all the registration requirements, and I've never really delved into how does that apply to me after my conviction. I understand that it's probably been contested and ruled on, but I was wondering, is there any way that I can challenge the fact that I am even required to register because
we're so short of time. Let me short this. Were you on any type of supervision as of July 1, 1995?
No.
You on any type of supervision? You were off all supervision. You completed all requirements to your sentence by July 1, 1995.
No, I was not released until 2003. My conviction's from 87, and I was required to register for life in Texas
You would be under SORNA version 1 in New Mexico, which would either have a 10 or a 20-year obligation. Are you listed on the internet? If you are, you're 20-year. Are you listed on the internet? Are you listed on New Mexico's
website?
I've
never checked, but I was told that I'm in the 20-year requirement.
Okay, well, that you may fit into our out-of-state translation case. Please contact us after this program. In fact, I'm going to write down your telephone. We'll contact you because you might fit in that case, as well as we're going to file a lawsuit challenging the constitutional of the retroactive application soon as we get a decision from the Tenth Circuit on Miller v. Rankin. So you're using is this 635 your number? Is that the good number to reach you on? Okay, and can you give me a first name?
Nicholas.
Can you give me a first name? Nicholas. Okay, Dick. I will Nicholas. Give you a call. Okay. So all right. Thank you. We've got one more in the queue, and then we're going to wrap up. So
thank you.
Another one from New Mexico. 505. You're on with Ashley.
Hey, Larry. Ashley, how are you?
Good.
I have a quick question for you. I spoke with you this morning, Ashlyn. If here a while back, I think it was in Michigan. I don't know if it was in the Seventh Circuit. There was a statement that the registration was, it was handed down by the circuit court, that the registration as it sat was putative. Does anybody remember that?
We all remember that. Can you? We're still up on the clock. Can you make it into a question?
Okay, I'm just questioning. With a decision, I mean, we talk about circuits and Supreme Court, but doesn't one circuit have to honor the judgments that are cut down in another circuit?
No, they don't.
No, they do not.
So, no, it's persuasive authority. Meaning that it can be cited to as this is fine work and you should be persuaded by it, but it's not binding. The Tenth Circuit is the one that's binding on us here in New Mexico.
Well, I knew that. I knew that. Very well aware of that. I was just because I keep reading about these other circuits, these other districts, and it sounds real good, but it doesn't seem to have any effect any place else. But yet, on some of the appeals I've written, some of them that I've read, they're using case law from other circuits to make the point. And I was just wondering why it isn't applying in our case.
Well, we actually very much intend to cite to all of those opinions in our lawsuits. We will say you should be persuaded by these, but we can't tell the court they're binding because they're not binding.
Okay. All right.
But we will cite to them every chance we get and say, you ought to be persuaded by this from the Sixth Circuit. You ought to be persuaded by this from the Seventh Circuit. But we can't say, and you're bound by this because you would lose all credibility if you tell a court they're bound by something they're not bound by.
Right. Well, I would say they can either pick and choose and twist and turn it the way they want to get to that, the way they want the decision to come out. So we're kind of behind the eight ball any way we look at it there. All right, I'll let you two go and let whoever else is waiting. Do we get along? Thank you very much for letting me in, Larry. Nice
you're the
to talk to you both.
You're the final
Thank you.
Caller. You're the final caller. So everybody, we have wrapped up this section of Narsil in Action. Ashley, did you have anything that you want to part with before we sign off for the evening?
The only thing that I would point out is that so the litigation that we have coming up in here in New Mexico in particular, but obviously across the nation for Narsil as well. This is just my shameless plug, and I'm one of the few attorneys that probably hates to do shameless plugs for money, but litigation is really expensive. So I encourage you guys to donate either to your local chapter or to Narsil or both, because we are moving mountains, even if it's incrementally, but it is expensive to move mountains. And that's my last thing, and I appreciate everything else.
Oh, wow, Ashley, that was very nice of you.
I know that eating thing is really, really tricky.
So, and I am going to announce who won the contest. I just got a text. The contest was won by a person in the Land of Enchantment in New Mexico. And
I think he cheated.
He rigged the system.
I think so. He can't be a personal friend of yours. Like he should be, you know, like family friends and all that's excluded. You can't win. That's my.
I know that he does a lot of good work with Titus House Ministries in terms of helping with reintegration of folks, getting them assistance to get identification, to get backpacks and wallets. So it's going to a great person who does a lot of great work. In fact, I'm going to let him come on and say a little something before we shut down. So this is our winner from the Land of Enchantment. Go ahead.
All right. I plan to see if I can attend that. Where is it? North Carolina? Raleigh.
So you will be welcome as you were in Houston and look forward to having you there.
That was a great conference in Houston.
Yes, and as I was saying, Don and his wife Alice, they do a lot of great work. If they had more money, they're in the same boat we are. If they had more money, they could buy more backpacks and wallets and bus passes and different things to do. Are you guys still giving out bus passes, or have you run out of money?
No, we're still giving them out clothing too and belts, and we help them with housing, trying to look for housing and jobs. So, you know, we write over 400, almost 500 inmates that are on the sex offender registry that are registered citizens.
In prisons.
Yeah, in prisons.
Largely. And in fact, very helpful to us at the state level to get the information to the prisons. The newsletter that you sent out for us, so the article that you sent out in your newsletter was very helpful to us.
Thank you.
So the prize was a registration to attend the 2020 conference without having to pay registration. So that was the prize that we awarded tonight. And the winner is Don from New Mexico. So
congratulations, Don.
So everybody, the program will be recorded for any portion you missed, and Andy will have it up within 10 minutes of the end of this. Is that right, Andy?
It'll be released before everybody goes to sleep tonight. No.
Andy will have it up as soon as possible on the NARSL website, and you can go back and catch any of the questions or any of the points, particularly on the removal process that you missed. And as always, we appreciate the support of NARSL. As Billy Graham's people used to say, it's your support that keeps the work that we're doing going, and we appreciate every one of you. And we appreciate that so many of you show up for these calls. It's flattering to do a call when there's 150 plus people listening in. So when we started this, we had 30, I think, on the first call thereabouts several years ago. And now this is, I think we're right at a record of people who signed up and participated tonight. So we're going to sign off. Good night, everybody. And thank you for joining us.